who we have, a panel of experts this afternoon. We have Sonny Miller from Trap Rock Peace Center, and we have Charles Shee and Miles from the Nuclear Policy Research Institute. And we're going to be starting today with Diane Henschel from Indiana University. She's with the School for Public and Environmental
Affairs.
And she's also with the Jefferson, she's a scientific advisor with the Jefferson Proving Ground Restoration Advisory Board.
I'm going to start by talking about health effects related to uranium. So I'm going to start by actually talking about uranium. And then I'm going to end with talking a little bit about our own little problem area related to depleted uranium, which is in southern Indiana, sort of southeast of here. What I'd like to point out before I even start any of this is that we're talking about a situation which is a low-level chronic exposure situation, unlike Hiroshima and Nagasaki, where you had a very high dose very quickly. And so therefore, in Nagasaki and Hiroshima, you had a lot of very rapid death and very rapid radiation sickness. And what you have here instead is a slow accumulation of both the radiation within their bodies and the effects of radiation over time. And as a result, what tends to happen is, because nobody's dying on them immediately, the Army had a tendency to say, and still mostly says, that it's not radioactive, it's not a problem, it's too low, it's not an issue. And in fact, over time, you accumulate the effects and you accumulate the radiation, and as you can see, it is a problem. All right, let's start talking a little bit about depleted uranium. There are more than these three isotopes in uranium that's used after processing, but the four that are naturally occurring and therefore the four that I'll focus on, is U-234, U-235, and U-238. And U-235 is that magic one that's slightly higher in specific activity, and therefore it's the one that's enriched for weapons-grade uranium. And therefore, depleted uranium is what remains after some, not all, but a good chunk of the U-235 has been removed. Just so you realize, it's an actinide element. It is a heavy metal, therefore. But it's a heavy metal that has, obviously, radioactive properties, which means that it disintegrates. It falls apart, and in doing so, it releases particles and energy that can harm things that it runs into, whether it's living or non-living. One thing I really want to point out here, you're talking about an element that has a phenomenal number of oxidation states. And it's these oxidation states that enables it to interact with different, with different other elements and determines what it's going to be able to do, whether it's in the body or out of the body. It will interact depending on its oxidation state. But it can change oxidation states both in the environment and in the body. But because it's got so many, it's a phenomenally flexible heavy metal, way more flexible than most of the ones that we normally deal with. It can combine with a huge variety of things, and it will always form different oxides, and which one you get depends on the oxidation state at that point. But anyway, it forms the oxides upon combustion, and you get a fair amount of combustion in war situations. What's really interesting is how many times I've heard, well, they're not water-soluble, and so therefore they're not going to go anywhere. And in fact, that's a fallacy. Some of them are water-soluble and are very able to dissolve into water and move around in the environment. And some of them, as they say, are not water-soluble. But regardless, if you breathe it into your lungs, it doesn't make a difference if it's soluble or water-soluble. It's in your lungs, it's in your body, and it's giving off radiation in the vicinity of cells. All right. How can you get exposed to the depleted uranium? How do people in Iraq, and how could we down, if we are anywhere near Aberdeen Proving Ground in Maryland, Yuma, out in the west and in the southwest, or here at Jefferson Proving Ground, and those are only three of the places, but those are the three main testing grounds. in the States. All right, it is going to end up in the soil, especially after being used as a penetrator or as a tank. And there was one type of tank that actually has a shell of depleted uranium to make it more difficult to be penetrated. And as the metal breaks up after impact, it's going to end up in the soil. And it's going to end up in the soil either as a solid material, and then it's going to oxidize over time, or it's going to fragment already, and then it's going to be in little fragments before it oxidizes. Whether it's in its oxidized form, and then it starts falling apart, and then it moves around, or whether it's fragmented, and it's still the tiny pieces of the metal, it's still uranium, and it's still got the radioactive properties, and don't forget that. All right. The soluble ones are going to migrate dissolved in water, and that means if you're in a flood zone, it's going to move around in the flood zone, both dissolved in the water and attached to the particulates. But even the insoluble ones can move around as particulate. We breathe in particulate all the time, especially if you're in a city or in an agricultural area where dust is moving around. You breathe it in, it goes into your lungs. The metal disintegrates and becomes airborne dust. It becomes airborne dust in war zones or in a situation where you've actually got it hitting a hard object. And don't forget, it doesn't have to hit a tank to disintegrate. It can hit another penetrator or another shell, or it can even hit a rock. Rocks are pretty hard objects and can also do a pretty good job of disintegrating metal that hits them at high speed. All right. Once then it's around, it's going to be moving around. It's also going to be taken up by plants. So if people are in the neighborhood and are growing vegetables, it's a metal. It's going to move. The soluble forms are going to move up into the plant and then be ingested by the people. As I said, in airborne, it's going to be inhaled. And the problem is it stays in your body. And because of its variable oxidation states and the way it can move, it can change oxidation states, it can join with different things and stay in different parts of your body. But the standard way that most metals move around in your body is, first place is going to be the liver, especially if it's in any way gets into your gut, into your GI, you end up eating it. If you inhale things and you cough it up, you'll end up swallowing it. So it'll end up in your GI. So that's the liver, first place. You try to excrete metals both from the liver and from the kidney. And in fact, the kidney stores metals. And so usually bioaccumulation is the greatest in the kidney. And then other places where it's going to store when it's replacing some of the other metals in our body. So uranium with an oxidation state of 2 is going to replace calcium and going to store in your bones. And it's going to store in your bones and be pulled back up and move around in your body if you're using calcium. If you're taking in more calcium and you don't need to pull up calcium, it'll just sit there in your bones and just affect what's in your bones. And do not forget that your bones are very close to your bone marrow, which is where you form your blood cells. And that's the reason why leukemia is one of the health effects that's at highest risk, because you get storage in the bones right next to where the blood is forming, and it's during that formation state that you get a highest risk of cancer forming in the cells. Because it doesn't move out of your body very quickly, because it's in your body for so many years, I think there's something over there that says it's got a half-life of 37 years in your body. That's not a short time. It's going to increase in concentration in your body over time, and it's going to increase in concentration up the food chain, which means that animals that eat other animals, and humans tend to be, unless you're vegetarian, people that eat other animals, or if you're eating contaminated vegetation, you are going to be taking in more and more, and you are going to also, therefore, increase the amounts. Okay, I'll talk about the health effects a bit. Now, one of the things I keep hearing is that DU is not radioactive, and that's a fallacy, and I'll point that out why in a minute. But the question is it radioactive then? Do the atoms still decay and release high-energy molecules or high-energy nuclear particles that can cause damage? And the answer to that is yes, and I'll give you the numbers on it in a minute. But therefore, it can cause cancer, and it can cause other health effects, both related to its metal properties and to the radioactive properties. All right. Radioactive decay, the major release is an alpha particle, which is essentially a helium nucleus. Helium's the number 2 element on our table, and that means 2 protons and 2 neutrons. So it's pretty heavy. They each have a molecular mass of 1, so it's got a molecular mass of 4. That's pretty heavy. But it also gives off beta particles, which are very light. They're effectively the size of an electron. And it also gives off pure radiation, pure ionizing radiation as gamma rays. So there's 3 forms of radioactivity that can be given off by uranium and its daughters. And so whenever I talk now for the next few slides, it's uranium and its daughters all the way through. So the alpha particles, and these are the ones that are in Du isotopes, are the ones that have the highest energy in general. In uranium, beta particles and gamma particles are only sort of medium energy. Doesn't mean that they can't cause damage. It means that they're less likely to cause as much damage, but the damage can still accumulate over time. And you can see that you're not talking about a huge difference. You know, the beta particles, even only at 100, if you've got 40 beta particles to 1 alpha particle, which you're not going to have, but anyway, if you have 40 beta particles to 1 alpha particle, you've got effective amounts of damage, or at least the amount of energy released. The other issue that's really important here is realizing alpha particles are the critical one. They don't travel very far. You have to have them in your body to cause health effects. But as I've already said, you breathe them in. And because you're breathing them in and they end up in your lung's going to be a target organism. But then if you choke it up and swallow it, it's going to travel through your body then. And wherever it ends up, whichever organs it ends up in, that's the cells that can be affected. Those are the highest energy ones, and they're heavy. And it's sort of like imagining within a cell having sort of a car colliding around. The car can do a fair amount of damage, you know, at the level of the cell. Because it's got a heavy mass. So alpha particles are strong enough, for example, to actually break DNA. Not just to damage it, not just to throw something off of it, but actually cleave it. That's the kind of damage that alpha particles can do. They can break proteins, it can break membranes, it can break parts of the cell because it's so heavy and it's moving around at high energy. The beta particles are much lighter, and more likely what you're going to see with them is sort of modifications rather than actual breakage. And the gamma particles, because they're relatively low energy, the same sort of thing, you're going to have more modifications rather than actual breakage. But even modifications can cause the cancer-causing changes in cells. Realize that. Also, it's the gamma radiation that penetrates from the outside the most. And as far as the soldiers are concerned, when they were inside the tanks, they were actually being penetrated by the gamma rays consistently the whole time they're in the tanks. And they are the ones that are at highest risk of cancer just from that sort of exposure. All right. This is fairly complex. The first one is the half-life on the top and the specific activity on the bottom. Just so you can see that U-235 has it's still got a relatively long half-life, but it gives off the most number of disintegrations per gram of the molecule. And that's the reason why it's wanted, because it releases the most. It disintegrates the quickest. But you can see it doesn't disintegrate all that much more quickly. I mean, it's more quickly, but it's not tons compared to some. And U-234 still has even greater numbers of disintegrations. And they're not enriching for U-234. They're enriching for U-235. All right, natural uranium has only about 0.7% U-235. For enrichment, you go up to 3%. That's about fourfold. And by the time you get down to depleted uranium, you're down to 0.2% of the U-235. You're not changing U-234 that much, and you're not changing U-238 that much. And therefore, as a result, when you actually look at radioactivity, in other words, how many disintegrations are given off per mass, or per, in this case, milligram of the metal, it's amazing to see that natural uranium is actually the most radioactive. Enriched uranium is, you know, not quite half. And depleted uranium is right up there. So in fact, it's the if you think about it, it's the disintegrations that are giving off alpha particles, beta particles, gamma particles. It's those disintegrations, those particles that cause the damage. And therefore, if you look at this, you realize that depleted uranium can cause almost as much damage as enriched uranium and only half as much damage as natural uranium, it is clearly still radioactive. All right. Talking about how you get effects from it, health effects from it. Got to break it down by particles. All right, alpha particles, that's the one with the small penetration, so you've got to have it breathed in or inside your body in order for it to penetrate. But because it's high energy, you're talking about really serious damage. With beta particles, it doesn't penetrate as far. It still can penetrate sort of through organs a little bit, 1 centimeter. You know, that's about half an inch. Lower energy, but still there's some damage that occurs, but it's not the same kind of gross damage that you get from the alpha particles. And the gamma rays penetrate from a distance, but the ionization potential is lower. There's still even lower damage. But remember, damage is cumulative over time. All right, so you inhale the alpha particles in general. Good evidence for cancer. Good evidence for lung, bone, liver, and leukemia cancer associated with inhalation of uranium. Indirect evidence for cancer in the kidneys, lymphoma, and myeloma, which are also two blood. So you've got 1, 2, 3 out of those are all blood-related cancers. And there's a fourth that's directly bone-related, so half of those are related to storage in bone. In uranium workers, that's part of where you see it. And again, prostate showing up, Hodgkin's is showing up, bladder, which is where you're getting the excretion from. All right, Gulf War vets. And the best studies are on our vets. And there's one ongoing study that's taking a group of male vets, only male, and following them and evaluating them every few years. And as they evaluate them, they are finding more and more damage and more changes. So this is the one from a few years ago, but the more recent study says that there's even more more changes, and some of the changes that used to be sort of within the range of normal, just sort of a little abnormal but not very, are now moving outside the range of normal and into the clearly abnormal range as they continue to be exposed and as the damage accumulates. Plus, when you're talking about cancer-type damage, it takes time for it to show up in our body. All right. The other issue is they're saying, well, we still don't have a lot of cancer yet in our Gulf War vets, and you wouldn't expect it yet. Children have a relatively short half-life for cancer. If you're exposed in utero, you might show up with cancer shortly after birth or within the first few years. If you're exposed as a little kid during your really growth phase, it might show up within the next 5 to 10 years. But if you're an adult in your past growing phase, then the cancer usually takes about 20 to 30 years to show up. The fastest cancer for an adult is maybe 10 years. Well, we are now only, 14 years outside. And these studies were done only about 10 years outside of the Gulf War. So you wouldn't expect cancer to show up. So every time you hear anybody say, but cancer's not showing up in our vets, well, we shouldn't have cancer yet, and it wouldn't have been caused by the Gulf War if it was. It's only now that we should start seeing cancer, and in the next 15 years, you're going to start seeing the cancer show up. And it's only now that you can start asking that question, is the exposure to depleted uranium causing an increase in cancer in the vets that were down there? All right. However, the other thing to realize, the same effects that cause cancer, the same type of damage also causes birth defects in a developing embryo. And there's access to the whole body because some of them are water-soluble and they move around in the blood, some of the forms of uranium. So therefore, it has access to all of the organs, and it has access, therefore, to the embryo if the woman is breathing it in. All right, this is some of what was talked about here in the film. They've shown that cancer rates in Basra increased tenfold between 1988 and 2001, and Basra is the hardest hit city. But in all of Iraq, you only saw about a 15% increase, but that's averaging over the whole of Iraq. Obviously, that means you're averaging the least exposed with the most exposed. So, of course, you wouldn't see the same rate of exposure because you've got the ones that aren't going to be showing effects with the ones that are averaging out the results. Cancer rates in children in Basra, just in 11 years, threefold. That's huge. Leukemia rates in the Basra children, the ones that are under 5 years old, 20-fold. My God, that's an epidemic. I mean, these are all clearly epidemic. 15% is enough for us to raise our eyebrows and for us to say that you don't use a drug if it's got a 15% increase in some sort of an adverse effect. When you get threefold, that's 300%. You know that there's a problem. Congenital malformations, sixfold or thereabouts. All right. Then the other issues that are being ignored, everybody always says, well, it's a heavy metal. I mean, it's radioactive, and it's regulated, by the way, as a radioactive element in this country. It's not regulated as a heavy metal, but it's a heavy metal, and it can do what other heavy metals do and replace the other metals that are in our body that are functional metals, which means that it's going to have places where it's going to sit, like in the bones, where we have something normally that's there and it's replacing it. So in our bones, it's calcium and uranium's replacing it. And we have long known, ever since Madame Curie, that radioactive elements replace calcium in bones. That's what she died of. And she had arthritis and she had crippled hands and she had deformed hands from her bones being affected by the radon and the radium that ended up in her bones. All right. So where do we expect it? We expect it in the lung, in the gut. We expect major routes of exposure to be inhalation and ingestion. But the damage, the difference, and what I'm going to talk about in terms of heavy metal stuff now, realize that's only when the heavy metal is there. So the heavy metal has to be in place, and it's causing changes in the way cells function or in structures in the cells. The radioactive part of it, it can cause damage to something that's not it's not actually directly interacting with. And especially like beta particles and gamma particles, it's quite a distance away. But even the alpha particles, you're not talking about something that is immediately there. So it can be bound into the bone, and it's affecting the blood-forming cells that are a little bit distance away. All right, DU can change oxidation state. It can therefore interact in the body, mimicking a whole host of the metals that are in our body. And the other problem that nobody has looked at, and I mean nobody, there is not a word in the literature about this. Other heavy metals get organified in our bodies, and some of them get organified in the environment. Once it's organified, it changes where it goes, and it changes its ability to affect things in our body and outside of our body. And nobody has looked at it, and yet there is no reason to think that uranium wouldn't be organified in the body. It's just never been looked for. And that would mean that it would be higher likelihood of going into the brain at that point, higher likelihood of storing maybe in fat, higher likelihood of moving into some of the tissues that have fat in them. There's a whole host of things that change once it becomes organified. And we don't know anything about whether or not uranium is organified, and yet there's no reason to think that it wouldn't. Every other metal is. All right. This is the same sort of things that I said before, and the problems basically show up, and you'd expect effects in the lung, you'd expect effects in the immune system, and therefore functioning in the immune system, and you expect changes in embryo, both forming, etc. And because it can replace calcium, that means that it's going to sit in bone, it can sit in nervous system, it can sit in muscle, and change functioning in the nervous system, and change functioning in the muscle. So what does that mean in terms of... Oh, wait a second. Now what? Okay. All right. This is just essentially the same thing in the mechanisms behind it. So are there indications of this that DU can cause these kinds of changes in nervous system, in muscle, in functioning, etc., as would be suspected if uranium is acting like a heavy metal and acting to disrupt and displace the metals that are normally in our body, the essential metals. All right. Kidney damage. That would be expected because that's where all metals are stored. And in fact, kidney damage is seen both in animals and, as I'll say in a second, in humans. There's changes in bone formation. That would be expected if you're seeing uranium replacing calcium. There are electrophysiological changes in brain function in animals. And there's clear lung damage, change morphology of the testicular cells, and evidence for birth defects. And the similar sorts of effects are all seen in humans when they're evaluated, both in the Gulf War vets and in some cases in the uranium workers. All right, and one of the problems is, and one of the problems that I deal with as a technical rep for Jefferson Proving Ground, is that we've got almost no real guidance for uranium. there is this one very pitiful guidance for the drinking water, but almost nothing else. And there's nothing to cover the ecological effects either. And notice that New Mexico proposes something that is about a quarter what EPA is allowing at this point. All right, so Jefferson Proving Ground is one of the testing places for depleted uranium in this country. And in fact, it's one of the primary ones in this country, and approximately 100,000 kilograms were used, mostly penetrators, at Jefferson Proving Ground. So it's south of here. It's a little southeast of here. Jefferson, Jennings, and Ripley counties. Pretty much you're talking about a fairly large plot of land, 55,000 acres, 2,000 of which was the depleted uranium one. The north portion, which the depleted uranium part is in, is now a national wildlife refuge. And some of the grosser contamination problems, like mountains of white phosphorus and stuff, were removed. Mountains of lead were removed from that before it got turned over to the animals. It's mostly a very fairly thin trench that it was all in, which also means that you're trying to hit in the same area constantly, which means that you have a much higher likelihood of hitting other penetrators, which means you have a much higher likelihood of being disintegrated rather than just slowly oxidizing over time. Anyway, they did recover every other year until they closed the base, or until they sort of closed the base. And they recovered about a fourth of it. And right now there's three quarters of it left. And as of this time, the Army says that they can't do any more recovery because it's too dangerous. It wasn't too dangerous for the 10 years that they were using it, but it's too dangerous now. I'm not quite sure why. They originally tried to decommission it and say that there was no risk from the depleted uranium whatsoever. With enough protests, they're now up to a 5-year license renewal cycle is what they're now proposing, which would, at least for the next while, mean that they do some monitoring in perpetuity. But because they don't like to monitor by actually taking samples in the real hot area where all the unexploded ordnance would be, and where, of course, the most depleted uranium is, they take their samples at the edge of the depleted uranium area, which means that they're doing some interesting monitoring. All right, this is it down here. Basically, they would fire right along this red line here, and this is the area, and the impact area was sort of like right down the center there. This part here has mostly been turned over to a developer after at least the isolated spots that were considered to be contaminated units were cleaned up. The rest of it, with its higher level of metals, is not being cleaned up because none of the metals are individually above action levels. But when you take metals together, they are. But it's not a concern. That's another issue. All right. There is clear evidence that there's depleted uranium at Jefferson Proving Ground. And in fact, that significantly more than just the trench is contaminated. 125 acres, which is more than the trench, is potentially got above 35 picocuries per gram, which is what they're considering to be their action level. They've got samples from soil, surface, and groundwater, sediment, vegetation, and animals. All have some depleted uranium in them. And it's worse when you have a stagnant water pool. Now, and then the deer samples that were taken before they did depleted uranium there, so 1983 deer samples, had no detectable uranium. The ones that were taken after they started using depleted uranium in the area shows not very high levels, but some levels of depleted uranium in the various tissues of the deer. Clearly, the deer are being exposed to uranium. It is getting out. The deer move around, and these are the same deer that the hunters shoot and eat. One other point that is not here, if you're not from this area, you don't necessarily realize we have a really interesting type of topography and weather system here. So we have, our bedrock is not solid bedrock, our bedrock is limestone. And the limestone is holy and has crevices, and the crevices can go for miles. And so if the depleted uranium is moving down into the bedrock, it can go anywhere and we wouldn't know it because you have to obviously look for it to find it. And most of the time that sort of meandering is ignored. But it's called karst topography and it's below the depleted uranium area. And it's an issue that's not being sufficiently addressed. And the problem that it can be migrating all over the place as a result of it is also not being sufficiently addressed. The other thing that we have here in southern Indiana is regular flooding in the spring. Now, when you think about regular flooding, we have a rain. The water comes up. It carries everything who knows where. Downstream, you get a fair amount of erosion during that period, and whatever's sitting there on top of the ground gets carried into the rivers and into the streams and then on downstream. So if you're finding depleted uranium in the sediments, that's amazing because that's got to be relatively recent because the sediments regularly, every spring, get washed out. And most of the springs around here in southern Indiana have relatively little sediment until you get to a stopping point which captures the sediment. And that's where you will find whatever contaminants there are. But if you're not looking for those places where you capture the sediment, mostly what you see is very little sediment that's just sort of washing out slowly during the rest of the year. And then every spring, they flood again. All right, more evidence for depleted uranium in the various samples here. And it's really interesting to me that they keep saying, well, there isn't much in the sediment. And I keep thinking, well, why would you expect much in the sediment? That there's any in the sediment means that there's some migration on a constant basis because of the flooding. They're ignoring the flooding, even though they sort of acknowledge that it floods. All right. And one of our problems dealing with depleted uranium is that Nuclear Regulatory Commission are the people that have oversight over the depleted uranium area and over anything that happens there, and they only address uranium as a radioactive element. And their only concern is uranium as a radioactive element. And clearly, uranium as a heavy metal has many more potential effects. You think about all the concern about lead these days. The same things that lead can do, uranium can do. The same interactions, the same ways to interact with the body, the same things that lead can disrupt, uranium can disrupt. The fact that the vets are showing up with changes in the way their brains are functioning, that their behavior is changing and that they don't do as well on the tests that evaluate brain function, indicates that just like lead gets into the nervous system and changes the functioning of the nervous system, uranium is doing it too. It is the sublethal effects, it is the subtle effects that are the heavy metal effects. And just like the radioactive effects, they are cumulative over time, and they increase as the uranium is going to increase in the body. And yet all of those effects are completely discounted because the only effects that are of concern for a radioactive element are cancer and then maybe birth defects. But none of these other sublethal effects are of concern, and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission doesn't even pay attention because that's as a heavy metal, and they don't deal with heavy metals. All right, so I am a little concerned because it's really frustrating. You can't talk to the NRC about the heavy metal stuff because they don't care. You can't talk to the EPA because the EPA doesn't have oversight over it until they develop guidance. And until, in some ways, there's a memorandum of understanding that changes, because right now the memorandum of understanding says that NRC is final say and EPA doesn't. And in our state, we have an even better situation because our Indiana Department of Environmental Management is not allowed to address radioactive metals. There is a state law passed that says that everything related to radioactive metals gets dealt with by the NRC and that it's not under IDEM's jurisdiction. So most of the time you have fallback to your state legislature, to your state guidance and to your state EPA people. We don't even have that. So it's an interesting problem that we've got. All right. So I think that we need to do more with this. This is where I'm going to end the talk. And this is the kind of thing that I'd be happy to talk about during questioning. But there's way more to happen today. So I'd like to turn it over to the next people. Okay, we've got about 10 minutes while they're doing whatever they're doing for me to answer questions. Yeah.
Well, it's reported in Iraq there have been increases in cancer rates, sometimes 10 to 20 more percent times, And but it's just, you know, really hasn't shown up in vets yet. I'm wondering if the difference could be that...
You can't hear in the back.
I was commenting on the fact that... Okay, I was commenting on the fact that there have been increases in cancer rates in Iraq, and we haven't seen that in veterans. It hasn't been reported yet, although I did read that there's been reported a 100% increase in birth defect rates among veterans of the Gulf War. But it hasn't shown up in veterans in terms of cancer while it has in Iraq. Could that have to do with the fact that the Iraqis are living in a constantly chronic contaminated environment? One scientist, Chris Busby, explained to me that although there is a latency period, it has to do also with the environment that you're in. If you're constantly exposed to radiation, that the latency period could be shorter.
Okay, let's go back to this issue that I compared Hiroshima to Iraq. And in Hiroshima, the cancer showed up relatively quickly. And in fact, after Chernobyl, some of the cancers, thyroid cancers, started showing up within 5 years, especially in the kids, but soon they were seeing it in the older people too. So it shows up more quickly at the higher doses. Effectively, what you're seeing is that the more damage that there is, the more quickly the cancer can show up. As much because you have more cells that are moving that way as because you also have these repair mechanisms, and the repair mechanisms throw in these growth factors, and it's the growth factors that are stimulating the cancer growth. So the more damage there is, the more repair there is, the more repair there is, the more growth factors there are, therefore the cancer can show up more quickly. The people that we're studying in these official studies of the Gulf War vets were there for a short period of time and have shrapnel embedded in their body. So they have a relatively limited exposure based on whatever's in their body and slowly disintegrating in their body. But the people that are there are breathing it, probably eating some of it, and are constantly exposed to it on a regular basis. Their exposure is therefore much higher, and therefore you'd expect the cancer to show up more quickly. And you'll notice that the children showed up even quicker, so their rates are increasing double what the adults' rates are. And that would be expected because they're in a period of growth. They have all these growth factors in their body. Their body essentially is not only promoting growth of them, but growth of the cancers at the same time. Did that help explain that? Okay.
Diane, I hadn't heard this term, organification. Could you explain that?
Metals in our body, in order to be used in enzymes or in certain structures, will often have something that's organic has a carbon attached to it. So it usually is a methyl or an ethyl group that's attached to it. So you've heard of methyl mercury or ethyl mercury, and it's worse than mercury itself because it moves around more, it has different properties, goes into different parts of the body, and it disrupts things differently. We don't know anything about whether or not uranium gets organified, but I can't imagine that it's not. Every other heavy metal is organified, so why wouldn't it? And it's a complete lack of study at this point. There's nothing. There's zero about it. Nobody's even considered it, which I think is amazing.
I'm going to get back a little bit to the domestic thing. My understanding is the Bush administration is making proposals that would exempt the Department of Defense properties like Jefferson Proving Ground and Aberdeen and all these different places from environmental regulation.
Oh, yeah.
But you're talking...
They haven't gotten through... They haven't gotten it yet, you realize.
No, they're pushing. They're continuing to push. But the thing is that you had suggested that there's not a clear-cut line here. The NRC covers certain parts of it. EPA covers other parts of it. But there seems to be a gray area as to who's actually responsible. You said that the EPA
Let's talk about Jefferson Proving Ground to begin with. Well, Jefferson Proving Ground is sort of interesting because it never went to Superfund, and so EPA never formally took over. Because under the BRAC process, the Army was allowed to say, we will do voluntary cleanup. Now, as soon as a company or the Army or anybody says, I will do voluntary cleanup, the EPA sort of backs off and says, okay, we're just going to do oversight. And that's the only role that EPA has had at Jefferson Proving Ground has been oversight and commentary. Now, it is true that in certain cases, when they don't approve things, the Army will turn around and try to change it. But there are other times where the EPA has said, I don't agree, and the Army has said, tough. And that happens more often than I like. And I think EPA has actually done a fairly decent job at Jefferson Proving Ground at trying to work within the recalcitrance of the Army and the characters that are involved in trying to get as good a cleanup as they could force. To me, it's disturbing that you have a situation where you've got, you know, high levels, relatively high levels of metals that don't hit the action level, but since they all act in this, in similar ways on the nervous system, they're acting together in the body. And we know in risk assessment now we're allowed to consider multiple contaminants, but it's not coming into play here.
And you didn't mention the fact that besides flooding, we have, in this part of the country, tornadoes and things like that.
Oh, there's one other thing that we have. Because it's now a National Wildlife Refuge, yeah, we have tornadoes too. But because we have it's a National Wildlife Refuge, Fish and Wildlife Service does clearing by a wonderful method of burning. So they do controlled burns. Well, the depleted uranium area has been burned now twice in 2 years, last year and the year before, because the first time it wasn't a sufficient enough burn. And they did it again last year. Now that's heat, combustion, swirling winds, and, you know, whatever uranium's right there at the surface is getting combustion with oxygen right there. So you're going to get the oxides forming in the air. The swirling winds are going to carry off the precipitate and the rust and stuff. I mean, think about when you've got something that's rusty that then goes through a storm, it comes out cleaner, right? Well, the rust had to go someplace. If it went through a flood, it went off with the water. If it went through heavy winds, it's gone off with the wind. Well, that's exactly what you're dealing with. You're dealing with the uranium rust here. And obviously, due to the weather, it's going to be moved around. So just because it oxidizes means that it's less likely to stay in place and more likely to move around at that point. That's good questions.
We have time for one more question. No, thank you.
And I'll talk to anybody anytime.
Great. Well, I've had, from Minnesota, we have a Superfund site where Alliant Tech Systems tested munitions. And so I attended 3 or 4 meetings, but I'm not a scientist, but we had both the EPA representatives and the NRC people out there. And I was interested, you're saying that the Nuclear Regulatory Committee or Commission only regulates materials based on radioactivity.
Yep.
And then the EPA, you say, is somewhat in limbo before oversight based on non-radioactive.
Yeah, there's a memorandum of understanding right now between the NRC and EPA that NRC takes precedence with radioactive materials. And until EPA develops guidance specifically for addressing sediments, soils, etc., NRC is the only place that there is any sort of numbers attached to whether or not you do something. And EPA doesn't, the people in EPA sort of go, we have no guidance. What are we going to do? And so in that situation, EPA is not going to be addressing the uranium unless somebody pushes them. And even then, they're going to sit there and do just what they do here, which is we have no guidance.
Okay. The other question I had, I was talking to a scientist, and she said that, I said that depleted uranium is nuclear because it's nuclear waste. And she said no. You can't say that. Depleted uranium is radioactive, which doesn't mean that it's not a serious problem. But she said it's radioactive, it's radiologic, but it's not, you cannot say that it's a nuclear.
Why not?
That's what I'm wondering. That's what I asked. What's your response?
It is
to that?
Maybe she's defining it according to fissionable material that can be used
right.
in a nuclear
she
reaction.
Fissionable.
And she's right that depleted uranium has so little U-235, and the other two elements, the composition of it means that it would be very difficult to put it into a nuclear warhead and have it explode.
Okay.
But it still doesn't mean it's not radioactive. which is interesting. It, you know, when you go on the Army's website and you look at what they say about depleted uranium, until relatively recently, they kept saying it's not radioactive. And I still hear, you know, in the past year, I've still heard, oh, well, it's not radioactive. What do you have to worry about? It's radioactive. It's clearly radioactive. In fact, it's, you know, if you go by Becquerel's disintegrations, it's pretty much almost as radioactive as the enriched stuff. It's just, but it is not fissionable. And that's true. It's not.
So then does that mean then that it's not fissionable, it doesn't explode, or unless on impact? What's the point about it's not fissionable? What's the characteristic of it?
I guess I don't know what you mean by explode. It explodes physically. You know, it's got that disintegration capability, but you're not going to have a chain reaction forming from it.
That's what fissionable.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not useful for nuclear bombs, and at that point, it's not as useful for nuclear power because those need chain reactions. But you don't need chain reactions for damage.
Okay.